special meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. You have an agenda before you, and I'd like to explain the agenda. Today, we will have an information item to continue our discussion on the budget. And the agenda item will focus on the information that staff needs to go out and prepare the change for the Fair Media. And so our discussion will be, how do we arrive at the conclusions of that direction that they need from us? While there is much more to discuss in this budget, I think if we can focus today on what is the agreeable fair amount, then I think it gives them the opportunity to begin. This will not be an adoption. It will be a direction for staff to move forward, but it does not, I caution myself to say it does not prevent changes, but we hope that we are in the right direction. Mr. Zimmerman, are you having a question about
I do have a question, yeah, procedurally, not being a member of this committee, but you said that this would be, that this is an information item, and then you said we would be giving guidance, or you would be giving guidance to the staff.
The committee will, yes.
That seems odd to me.
Well, it is not, we will not adopt anything today, because that is not where we are, but we will act to say that from the committee where and how they will move forward.
So the staff will know the opinion of the four members of the committee and are going to do something with that?
We will continue then in this, the staff will begin making the changes that are needed. And I think if we began our discussion, we may get a clarity as to how we get there.
And what happens then? Will this then go to the board or will it come back to the committee?
It will come back to a committee. We have not done the entire, we will not conclude the entire budget today.
And the board could decide that that's not the direction we want to go in at all. We want the number different. We want the mix different. We want everything done differently. And staff understands that.
Well, staff understands that we will try to be as conclusive today as possible.
I guess my question is, how can the members of the committee, who are not the full board, be conclusive?
Well, I will say that we can hear all input and consider it in balance of that. But we are not a board to act here today. And we are not having a special board meeting to do this. May 13th gives us an opportunity to solidify more of the budget process using what we have today, but it does give us opportunity to make
revisions.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McKay.
And I just want to clarify one thing, because at the last meeting we had a robust conversation about the timeline, and I see that that's in here, and the pressing issue that the staff has to be able to program, deal with some fair changes that we've never done before. Peak of the Peak and other things. And so as I expressed at that meeting, I'll express again today, we need to give them some direction. We recognize that changes and tweaks might have to be made. But frankly, we have to begin testing, preparing for a new fare structure so that our customers who will pay more for these services are not increasingly aggravated when they get to the fare gate and run into a technical glitch for a fare change that we may be doing for the first time. And so while I understand Chris's dilemma and appreciate that, I do think that, you know, we have to give them some basic structure to begin looking at programmatically how you would implement these fare increases should the board approve them, and obviously we can make tweaks to them. I would hope there's not widespread changes that get us back to the drawing board, because I remain very concerned with our ability to implement major changes to fare structure in a way that when our customers arrive at the gates on implementation day, they're not inconvenienced. And so I just want to make sure that point is not lost in this. That actually is driving some of the urgency to have the board come to some type of an understanding of where we're heading with fare structure, because there's nothing, as I commented last week, I mean, nothing worse than asking a customer to pay more and then having them have trouble get through the fare gate because our technology isn't caught up with the changes that the board has made. So I just want to make sure that point is not lost in trying to come to grips with what the timeframe is.
Okay. Any other questions about the agenda? What we're doing today?
No. Well, I have a question. I'd like to follow up on Mr. McKay because I, too, am concerned about the timeline. Marilyn is concerned about the timeline, and it's, you know, we have a package that's been in front of us, and we have to tweak it. We may have to tweak it somewhat, but I agree that I hope it's not widespread. Marilyn came here ready to vote last week. We were ready on this last week. And, yes, it included some things that we weren't particularly thrilled about, but we still have this huge deficit that we have to address. And we're trying desperately to compromise and get to a point where we're ready to vote. So we have to close this huge gap, and we came ready, and including our additional subsidy. So I think if we can at least get to this portion of it, at least to provide some direction, that would be very, very helpful. Because we're hearing constantly every week from Ms. Kissel and Mr. Sauls that time is running out, and we have to get to the point where we can at least give some direction on this.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hewitt. We understand your concern. Okay, Ms. Kissel.
Great. Thank you. So as Ms. Hudgens indicated, the purpose is to provide the direction for the fairs specifically. And the next chart is quite a busy chart, but I would hand it over to Jim Hughes to provide a brief explanation. This goes directly to the implementation of the fare increase for June, to be prepared for June 27th, and the activities that need to take place on a timeline. And Jim Hughes actually is coordinating that effort cross-departmentally for the agency, and I would like to have Jim take you through the chart.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. The left side of the chart, and I apologize for the busyness of the chart, but there are a lot of activities done by various departments within in Metro. So I've tried to organize the steps, and I'll bring you through the key timelines about what has to be done. Beginning on the left-hand side of the chart, the red box all the way over that starts at day one, we get direction in terms of what fares we would like to start the program. We have to actually calculate the fares. Our fares aren't 10% above what the existing fares are. They are a structure that says the base fare is this, the mileage fare is this, and step miles. So we actually have to calculate the fares. Our calculations is station to station, as you know, so it's 86 by 86. There's various fare tables off of that, base fare, the peak fare, the senior citizens fare, a number of other fares. So we calculate actually six tables to go into that so that we can lock down on all of those matrices and say, okay, now we all know what the fares are. There is some input into that, into what the passes are and how the integration works between rail and bus. And that typically takes us a little bit more than a week. We put 10 days up on this list because there are some different functions in there. Is there a peak of the peak? There's a $4 flat fare. While all this has been going on in the discussion between staff and the board, we've actually been having the programmers see what works. So when we tell you that you want a flat fare after 12 o'clock, 4 o'clock, we know that that works. We've ran it through some of the new systems, so we know that that will work. If you want a peak of the peak, will the systems accept that? The answer is yes. We've done this sort of testing. Will it work? But we haven't done any testing about specifically what the fare is. That would be the next set of that. So the first 7-10 days of this, we have people lock the room and they just calculate all the fares. We have to do it on a couple of systems. As you know, our rail system is being upgraded from a legacy system to a Next Fare 5. So as we calculate the fares, we actually calculate them now in two different systems. We compare them, make sure everything is there. And you get to that key point where the first star comes in and says, we're now ready to release the fare information to people that are going to do something with it. If you follow directly across the row where the red is, all of that purple goes to our engineering department, which is actually the programmers. They're the ones that sit down and program the legacy system, the next fare system, they'll program the bus systems, they'll talk to the bus, I'll get back to that, but they're all the programmers. So they do a whole bunch of programming, again, all the tables, they do testing of it, they do, and then they bring it back and they do verification. And actually, in the end of this, take a machine, program it up, run every single fare through it to make sure that it's right, so that when we download them into the system at the end of this process, everything is right. So it is a lot of work, and we've laid them out there. If you go above the bar in the middle where the stars are, and you go to that blue area that's up there. Sorry for you that, don't black, that it's in black and white. We also give the information to producing signs. All of the signs have to be updated. Our signs are, again, station for station, so that when the customer goes up, it's specific. I get on this station, where am I going through? Those stations are there. So the signage is like 86 different signs, and we print like 20 of them to put over the fare gate. Some of them go are stick-ons that go over the fare gate. Some of them are part of the where that's backlit. And then there's also the signage that's below the on the kiosk. So there's a different types of materials done by different types of people. But the first part is give it to them. Let them get the fares into their system so that they can start their production of producing these signs. And again, it's a fairly long process because we're not printing 50,000 of one. We're printing 86 different matrices, maybe 20 to 30 times. And so that blue line that goes across there that talks about, okay, we've completed it. We've already have a preliminary design about how we would deal with the peak of the peak, because it's different what the customers have to see. So the signage has to have an extra column on it. How does it work? If we were to implement it later, how would we do all that? We've done some of the preliminary work, but we've done nothing with the specific numbers. A little bit of proofing. It goes to plant. It goes to, our plant operation actually produces a sign. Some of them are stick-on. Some of them are laminates. Some of them are hard copies. And they get put on by both bus and plant 2 weeks prior. In addition to that, talk a little bit about bus. Once we change our bus fares, we have to know what the local carriers are doing, because all the fares are integrated. Some carriers automatically will increase their fares to ours. Some won't. All of the local jurisdictions have a little bit of a different approval process. They have to approve their fares. Our problem is all of our fares are integrated. So if there's a transfer between Ride-On and us, what is their base fare? Each system has to know it. The Metro system has to know it. The Ride-On system has to know it. And all of those programming is done by the same programmers, Metro programmers. That purple box in the middle, it's the same group of people. So we've laid out that there is a time period where we will tell them that says, as we move forward, by the middle of May, you have to give us concurrence as to what your fare is, and we'll program it. That gives some time that, you know, we take emails, we're fine. Board approval will do that. We've had some counties already indicated to us, if your fare is going up, we automatically want to match yours. That's the easy ones. It's the ones that are on the fence that take us time, and yet it affects all of the programming, because it could be a transfer between Ride-On and Arlington. Not that there's a lot of them, but once we do the programming, it's got to be in there. Again, back to the same people that are doing the programming on the level. That goes back to the programmers, also goes to the bus people. We produce signs for each of the fare boxes that go on there. We program the fare boxes. We do the same testing, and then we get ready to get the information out to the buses. They begin downloading it the week before in each of the divisions. They'll send it out to each of the counties about a week before, and we start a download process. We upload it on the buses the night before and turn it on, but we download it each division so we can test and that it's out there. So that's how we get to the bus side. Treasury, the green line across the middle, gets into when are they ordering tickets and when do they start selling tickets. Monthly tickets are sold on a certain date, so they just need to know how much am I selling it for. And they've done some ordering of stock so that there's no prices on it, so the prices come out later. But if you're going to sell a monthly pass 2 weeks before the beginning of the month, they have to know what they're selling for, and we have to get the signing up there. So it's not necessarily on the critical path, but we need to get the information to public about 40 days before so that we can sell the appropriate pass. Last piece on the top is a general marketing to our customers. We do have fare brochures that go out there. Everybody notices most of the information goes to the public through the press, through what's going on today. So people know about it, but we have to remind everybody all the time that our fares are going up. They can get a brochure. We give stuff for the station managers to help them on the first few days to get the information out to the public. There are a couple other slight complications with all this as you get into parking, may or may not requiring some programming for how we do the Lexus machines that sells the cards. Need to work our way through that. I don't think they're big deals, but it comes back to the same programmers. So the key in the middle of the programmers is they have to know what the fares are so we can leave them alone and let them program everything. And they have a very detailed schedule that says, first I program all the rail fares, then I start with the bus stuff, then I do the parking stuff. We've decided in the last couple of fare increases that the last signage is always parking. We tend to put up stickers at the end of it and have to go back and put up permanent signs after that, but it's an easy fix to do. And because of our manpower, those are how we manage our staff. I went through this fairly quickly, but I think that covers all of the items. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you for producing the chart. It's very useful. One of the questions that I have is, at the last meeting, we discussed direction and also whether the fares had to be expressed as absolute values or a range to be inputted into the system in order to test it. So, for instance, suppose there was some consensus by the committee that they'd like to see peak of the peak charges, but they said, well, 10 or 20 cents. What are the implications on this timeline?
If it's the basic fare, if it's the flat fare or the mileage fare, and that changes, we have to go back to step one. Because we can't program a range, we can't program this. If you say our base fare goes up from a $1.25 to $1.65, we program. You come back and say it's $1.55. We've got to start the whole process over again. You mentioned an item which is peak of the peak. As was discussed at your last meeting, there are some items that require that can only be done through the next fare five, the upgraded system on the rail side. The peak of the peak is one of those. The $4 flat fare is another one of those, and the third one is the cost differential between the paper card and the smart trip card. Those things can only be implemented system-wide when next fare five is fully implemented. We've got a number of stations up now. We have a program that says the completed implementation will be completed sometime in early July. So even as we're talking about, as mentioned last week, as we're talking about a June 27th fare increase, those three specific items, as Carol mentioned, would be implemented on or about August 1st when the technology is up. So that's not an issue. You mentioned the peak of the peak. We've automatically assumed in all of our calculations that comes in 1 month later.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Yes, Mr. Zimmerman?
So do I understand the chart correctly that I'm seeing here? There are two stars that appear there. One on the left and one not on the right. Are those the dates between which you actually, just tell me what is the first star telling me?
The first star we put up there because that is our commitment to all of the support departments that we know what the fares are for.
Okay. So that's a key. So that in fact is the start point from where you actually set the ball rolling here to.
Yes, assuming.
Okay, that's what I thought. And the second star then is the point at which you're ready to go with it?
The second start is we actually roll it out of all the programming into the facilities, both bus and rail and the local carriers.
So the period defined by that boundary, one star to the next on that line, is actually the time you need to be able to make the whole thing happen.
Yes, but I do need to know by the first star what all the fares are. I can't.
That's what I'm saying. So if you know by the first star, then the second star is the soonest you can actually make it happen. And exactly how many days are there between there? That's from day 46 at the end. What's the first day? Is that day 16?
14 to 48, I think, are the numbers.
Say again, 14 to 48?
I think it's 14 to 48. Do that in my head.
Okay, so 34 days is what you need.
It's about 7 weeks.
Just a little over a month. So if we want to be ready to go on June 27th, let's say, then you really have to know by the third or fourth week in May, basically.
Still have to do the matrices, and the time after the last week, there's a lot of activity going on. The last star is not an implementation. The last star is to get the information out to all the divisions. They then have to get it into 1,500 buses, or excuse me, with the local carriers, close to 2,500 buses.
Okay, let me ask the question differently then. If you wanted, if we want a new fare to go into effect on June 27th, what is the absolute latest day this board must make the decision and tell you, here's the package we want?
Let me help you, Mr. Hughes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to sit here and tell you we need 60 days.
Well, you're not going to get 60 days because that would be now. And the board doesn't meet today, so you're obviously not getting 60 days.
Well, this goes back to the question that was raised by the chair before, that to give direction now, we would be able to make June 27th, understanding that if the board decides something differently, and if it, other than maybe a little tweaker here, but if it's changing the fare, we recycle, so we're not making June 27th.
Yeah, well, again, following up on Mr. Acosta's point, I mean, that seemed to be clear that you can't just tweak the thing a little bit. That, you know, if you change it, then it starts the clock all over again. The clock cannot start today. The board does not meet today. There is no board here to give such direction in any final way. So, I, frankly, the idea that it takes 60 days to do this is amazing to me. But if that's what it takes, then I think we have to start thinking in terms of a fare increase that goes into effect later, because that decision cannot be made today.
Well, let me tell you, Mr. Graham, just one moment. I understand what Mr. Zimmerman has expressed, but I think considering where we have been in this discussion, we cannot continue to labor as to what it will be. The best, I think we have accepted that we can give direction to staff and that we really do hold the trigger as to whether or not it will be good direction or not. And if there is debate afterwards, then we will have put ourselves at risk. I think it's not only, there are two parts about how, what will happen, because I think it is not only a timing issue, it's what revenue we generate in the summer as to whether we start the fare increase at the beginning of the fiscal year or into the fiscal year and how much revenue we lose or gain. So I think we,
the next question.
Yeah, that is it. Mr. Graham.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And please
speak
into the mic, I think.
Oh,
for some
thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I do want to first express my appreciation for your diligent efforts in navigating these somewhat challenging waters, but it is very sincerely appreciated, and I want to say that at the outset. The second thing is that for the District of Columbia, this is a problem of our process. I mean, as you could, if you read today's Washington Post, you would have been reminded that we're in the midst of our budget. We, you know, and I have these 12 colleagues who think rather independently. And I have not even had a vote in my committee on this budget. And so while Maryland and Virginia are in a different fiscal year and thus on a different schedule, their fiscal year ends June 30th, ours ends September 30th, it's a different budget schedule. So that's the first part of this dilemma. And I appreciate all of the other aspects of this, but I have to share my own issues, which is the District of Columbia doesn't have a budget. We're about a third of the way through our budget. There are a lot of moving parts to this decision. I'd much rather consider this budget as a whole, but I'm trying to work with the realities of the fare needs as well. The question that I have is, if Mr. Zimmerman has pointed out, I think accurately, we have no board meeting today, so there's no action today, I believe, possible. So, and Mr. Sarles has on various occasions, as has Ms. Kissel, indicated to me that if we set some kind of guidance, you can proceed and then we can subsequently modify it. And this is the question that I have because I'm puzzled. If we can do that, why can't you just proceed with all of what's needed here? And I must confess I don't understand every aspect of this, and we could go into every aspect, I suppose. But why can't we just pick a number out of thin air and then come back to it later and just simply change the number if you are saying to us today that we can provide guidance which can be subject to future modification? Do you understand the question? I'm just not understanding how we could do one and not the other.
I understand the question. And what we tried to outline was that for most of the fare information, if it's changed,
then we have to recycle and basically go back to square one.
Let me interrupt you because I've asked this question so many times, and therefore we could not do a guidance today subject to future modification without having to recycle the whole thing.
You could do a guidance.
Reset it.
You could do a guidance, and other than a couple of exceptions that Jim mentioned before, if you elected to change, and we go down that route, it's a risk you take, a business risk, nothing else. You go down that route, and if in the end the board adopts that, good. We're ready to go on June 27th. If in the end the board makes changes that impacted enough along the lines we just talked about, then we have to recycle, and we do two things. We end up beyond June 27th, whatever that date is. That impacts your revenue, as you point out.
So in other words, the guidance doesn't work today either, because the assurance that I've been getting is that we could give you a guidance with the comfort of knowing that we could subsequently modify the specific number. And so that is, in fact, not the case. And that what you're asking us to do is actually establish a new fare schedule today, which we cannot do. And so I guess that's it. I mean, you can't get a blood from a turnip. That's what my grandmother said. And there's nothing we can offer up because we can't act today. The District of Columbia cannot act today. And we would be willing to consider a guidance subject to future modification. But you're telling us that doesn't really serve your purpose. Am I right?
Leave it to the chair. What I'm saying is you can provide the guidance. We then, staff, will then proceed to program it. And if the board acts on that guidance as it's laid out today, then we're all good. If it decides to change it, we will have spent some time and energy to have done it, and we'll just have to put that aside and start where we are when the date
gets
there.
So we may as well wait.
Not
until
really.
We're ready to.
Well, it's up. It's obviously whatever you want to do, but it gets down to the fact that if you, as the chair pointed out before, if you wait later to make the decision, and it's different than say the guidance today, you then have to deal with the revenue implications, and there has to be more revenue coming from someplace else than you are today. I mean, it's a business decision as to what you want to do.
And let me add one thing. It's really about risk. So if we actually have some guidance, we actually are going to be mitigating our risk for implementing a fare increase properly right for our customers day one when we need it. If the board does not want to act, all it does is it increases the risk of getting the fare increase right day one when we need it. So that's a board decision. We're just laying out the actual functions and activities and laying out the timeline. I understand, Mr. Zimmerman, you indicated that 60 days is clearly too much. In our estimation, Dave Kubicek and I manage most of the people who are actually doing the work under these activities. And our assessment has been laid out here that it takes 60 days because of the legacy system and the new system that we're upgrading at the same time. That's our opinion.
I heard you say that. I just said it was amazing to me.
I understand. Yeah. But
and where is the appreciation for the D.C. budget process?
Oh, I certainly have appreciation for that budget process.
You just keep moving by that as if it was a detail.
I certainly respect the jurisdiction's budget process.
Excuse me. It's not a detail. You know, it's a very – and in years previous – these actions have been taken in June. You know, last year when we cobbled things together, it was late May, June. And we were able to, our budget process was in the same, had been completed. You know, but I mean, you're not answering my dilemma, which is I cannot speak for the Council of the District of Columbia and say this is what's going to happen.
I understand.
Mr. Benjamin, I really am spellbound. We're here to give guidance. So I think the first and foremost thing we have to decide, are we going to raise fares? Because otherwise, I think we're moving away from what we want to do in this budget. And if we're not going to raise fares, then you've got to start this process over. I think we have a foundation,
And I think what we're trying to do is build on that foundation today. So let me go to Mr. Benjamin, and then maybe we can walk through some of this, and we can decide whether we will or will not be able to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would characterize this as providing information to the staff that can be useful to minimize risk, as Ms. Kissel noted. No, we cannot today vote on a fare structure. And so long as we don't vote, there is no answer on what fares will be, because at any point the board could decide to do something different. But to the degree that there is general consensus today among those of us who are here, and I would note that there are voting members from all of the jurisdictions here, including the federal government, it does tell us that we probably, and I consider Mr. Acosta to be the voting member at this moment, not on this committee. I'm not saying anything about this committee. I'm talking about voting members. I know that Mr. Acosta has talked closely with Mr. Downey, and that the two of them appear to be pretty much of the same opinion. It does give us the opportunity now to give guidance and say, this is the way it looks. This is a reasonable, as Ms. Kissel points out, business risk to move forward on trying to get this done. If the board, in its wisdom at a later date, says, no, we don't like that guidance, the board has the right to change it, even dramatically. But it at least gives us some starting point and allows the staff to move forward with some understanding that at least many of the members do feel comfortable with whatever we decide today. Now, relative to those decisions, and I was very interested to hear Mr. Graham talk about the DC budget process and how this interferes with the DC budget process and that DC is not ready, I would note that many people characterize Maryland as being the state that was unwilling to vote and unwilling to make decisions. And as you heard earlier from my colleague, we in Maryland were ready a week ago to vote, and we are ready today to vote, even though voting today would not mean anything relative to the overall board. But we were very, very pleased with the initiative that the general manager showed. We were very, very pleased with the proposal that he put out there, in spite of the fact that it may be that the gentleman from Virginia doesn't feel comfortable with that. It was an opportunity for us to move forward, and we were ready to vote, even though it now appears that some others were not ready to vote. And we still are in that position. We supported the increase that we would have to do in our subsidy. Note that when the original budget came out, one of the things that was held constant was total subsidy. But that didn't mean for every jurisdiction it was total. For those of us in Maryland, it meant that we had an increase of $9 million, while other jurisdictions, including Virginia, had a decrease. So it was very hard for us to stretch beyond even 9 million. It was very hard for us even to get to 9 million. And as I have said last week and as I have said before, the state of Maryland has got a significant budget problem, particularly with its trust fund. We have deferred $2 billion in projects in that trust that are funded by that trust fund. We are in a situation in which there have been reductions across the board except one significant place, and that's here at Metro. We have been in a situation where many highway projects have been canceled. Every other transit system in Maryland is seeing reductions. The community in which I live, Garrett Park, and every other municipality is seeing a 90% drop in state aid to their transportation programs. And in spite of that, the state of Maryland has increased its commitment to Washington Metro. And when the general manager made a proposal to increase it even further, we struggled very hard and said, okay, $14 million is a possibility for us, and we were ready to go with that. The numbers can't keep changing, and they can't keep going up, because we are, in fact, the one that has made the largest increase, a 6.5% increase that we have been willing to commit to and that we have said here that we can vote for. And it's really uncomfortable when people say anything other than that. There is a clear, absolute commitment by the state of Maryland to this authority and to the service it provides and to funding that to the best of its ability.
Madam Chair, and a personal privilege.
Mr. Graham,
since I was mentioned by the Speaker.
I'm going to let Mr. Benjamin finish. Mr. McKay had his hand up as well, and we're going to finally get to discussing what the items are. Thank you.
My apologies.
You're going to finish, though.
My apologies, Madam Chair. I will finish. What I was trying to say is we are in a situation in which we have made commitments. We can't keep changing those commitments because we already are well beyond where we reasonably could be, but we are still hanging in there. We need to tie these things down. We need to make decisions. We need to move forward. At a minimum, today, we need to all decide that the staff should be able to move forward with programming the proposal which the general manager has made for fares. There may be minor tweaks to it, but basically that is a reasonable business risk, and I hope we will be able to give that direction, even though we may do it informally and without formal decision by the board.
Mr. McKay.
I actually was just, now that we've editorialized for an hour, I was just going to suggest that we get on with the presentation, but I did want to add one statement that I don't want anyone thinking that it was particularly easy for jurisdictions in the Commonwealth of Virginia to set aside an unknown amount of money at a time when we had pressing resources and pass a budget not knowing how much money we would have to set aside for Metro. I would actually find it a luxury if we were in a budget process still, and we knew what the figure was, and we were told this is what your contribution was, and it was non-debatable, and then we had to act on it. But to think that it was some easy task for boards in the Commonwealth of Virginia to set aside an unknown amount of money to make a commitment to WMATA when we had other pressing needs, and frankly, we don't have a highway department left in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I can't even get a pothole filled. So to set aside money in that environment was no easy task. So I don't want anyone thinking that our schedule somehow was convenient for this process. The reality is the regional transit system has a schedule. It's a different schedule than some other places, but the fact of the matter is what we heard crystal clear is we're getting dangerously close to A, losing revenue because this board can't act and give staff some guidance on what to do, or B, really inconveniencing our customers who we're going to ask to pay more when they show up and they don't know what the fare structure is or our programs aren't set to deliver it. So as long as I'm sitting on this board, I'm trying to get us to move forward to give them some direction to prevent both of those things. Neither one of them would be good. And at some point in time, we're going to have to make a decision. And the longer we prolong this process, the either more revenue we're going to lose or the more upset our customers are going to be. It's just the reality of the schedule that we're in. And we can't change the schedule of WMATA to accommodate everyone. It certainly is not convenient for us when we had to act on our budget and set aside money ahead of time. That's no easy task either. So hopefully we can get through the presentation. We can give you some guidance today and remove some variables of either revenue loss or inconvenience to our customers, which is why we set up the special meeting today to try to get that ball moving forward.
Mr. Graham, do you still have?
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm listening to Mr. Benjamin. I just have the reaction that things are getting curiouser and curiouser and curiouser. You know, and I'm going to bite my tongue. I'm not going to go any further. I'm not going to complicate this further, except to say that. I do want to say that, you know, what might be more acceptable to us is recognizing the complexities of our budget process. It's just a process, man. You're a legislator. You know what processes are about. So, you know, these flourishes aside, you know, I mean, we've got to deal with the decision-making process, and we've got to deal with it respectfully. or I can't work in that area. I'm chairman of the Committee on Public Works and Transportation. I've got a whole role over there that has to be respectful of my colleagues, and surely you can appreciate that, Mr. McKay.
I live it. Okay.
But you live it. That's why you can appreciate it. But look, if we were to do a guidance, and I don't know what the legality of this, Ms. O'Keefe is here, she can tell us whether a guidance by a committee of this board can actually instruct on issues such as fare increases, but that's just a legal question that comes to mind. But if we were to do a guidance, which included the whole budget, if we were to say today that this committee is comfortable with the whole budget, we have a couple of things, you know, that we would like to put to the general manager, so that we had a sense of the unity of all of these parts and a sense of comfort with all of that, because there are issues here as well. When you take just one element, we've never taken one element out and move forward with one element and left everything else to be decided. If we can do that, I mean, I think insofar as the District of Columbia, I think if we had an understanding, at least at this committee level, you know, about those other budget issues, then I think we could send a message of guidance in the interest of comedy and cooperation, trying to work these issues out so that all of the considerations that have been made so eloquently can be met. I'm willing to consider that.
I think we can move forward to talk about the fare increases then, and I think that's what...
In the context of the whole budget.
Well, we will always have the whole budget in front of us. And if we want to go beyond that, but I think one element of this is how much revenue will we generate from the increase of fares, and it becomes the baseline of how we can build the rest of this line. So let us begin the presentation now, and I think what we would like to...
But did you understand the point I made?
I did understand your point.
Okay, because okay. It sounds like you're just moving ahead with the other approach.
No, that is not the case. I think you can hear this presentation, Mr. Graham. You can decide what elements of this fare increase in the varying presentations we've had that we wish to build. And if you wish to offer guidance on the other parts of the budget, that's also very important to us. Okay. But I think we need to do this part. Ms. Kissel, would you go ahead?
Yep.
And I guess I wanted to set the framework in that we started with the general managers, which we had $89 million of fare revenue, and Mr. Sauls moved us to the 101 or 102.
Yes.
And what we're trying to do today is build on those two and generating a baseline that we can work from. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it will be the acceptable one that we will move with.
Okay. And actually, I just have a few more pages. This slide talks about a nuance that we recognized after we presented the general manager's budget last Thursday, where we could possibly, in the general manager's budget, we had recommended a surcharge for parking at 50 cents. A consequence of that, if the board acts on that, would be that we would have some of our parking lots are actually already priced at $4.75. So if we actually had this 50-cent increase, that would take it to $5.25. A consequence of that would be if a customer did not have a smart trip card to exit the lot, they would have to go back into the station, access the current machines that dispense the smart trip card currently, which is a $10 fee to the customer. They pay $5 for the smart trip card, and they get a $5 value in order to get out of the lot. As a result of that potential increase, the customer would have to take the card and then add another 25 cents onto the card in order to exit the lot. And obviously that would be a very large inconvenience to the customer. A small change would be actually to just change the smart trip card price that is currently at $5 to $4.75. It's a very nominal revenue loss. I believe it's less than $100,000 given the current amount of smart trip cards that we currently sell, and it would solve the issue there if the case is that the board recommends a 50-cent surcharge on parking. So we wanted to note that.
Okay. All righty.
Ms. Hutchins made a comment on it?
Yes.
That makes a lot of sense, obviously. Should we move to increase fares or parking fees by 50 cents? I don't see a problem that I would have, or I imagine Ms. Hewlett would have, in reducing the price of a Smart Trip. I would note also that unless things have changed dramatically, Smart Trip sale revenues goes into a reserve, which is used for buying Smart Trip cards, yes. So it should have no effect whatsoever on the budget.
That's correct.
Okay, so this would be a small change. It would still keep the philosophy of charging for Smart Trip, but it would make it an awful lot easier for people who have to buy one. So should we go there? This probably ought to be added in as a line item in the fare change because you're changing the value of the sale of the Smart Trip.
I don't think it's a tariff change, but I'd have to. Right.
Isn't it something that the board would have to approve somehow? Yeah, so
we'd
want to have that in as one of the changes that we would make to make sure that all the bases are covered.
Yes, Mr. Zahn.
Of course, another way to approach this would be to lower this charge for Smart Trip card further. Given that we are interested in getting everyone, or at least as many as absolutely possible, to use Smart Trip, I don't understand why we are continuing to charge $5 or even $4.75. Seems to me it would almost make more sense to charge somewhat more on fare, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you could, again, I don't know what the right rate on the parking is, and that should be probably set by parking demand, but the idea that that's limited because of the charge for the Smart Trip card seems illogical to me. I think a case could be made for giving the cards away at this point, but I think we should very seriously look at, in the overall package we're talking about this year, dramatically reducing the cost, say, to a dollar. For those who believe that some charge should be made for it, that would still have a charge, but it would be closer to nominal and would reduce part of the objection to Smart Trip, especially for those of lower income. And it seems to me it's more consistent with our whole goal here on fair policy overall.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
And we can look at that if you like. The next chart actually this is just a chart that we showed last Thursday, given the general manager's proposed budget. We actually recalculated the subsidy impacts to the jurisdictions. We actually had some slight change to the subsidy impacts that we presented last Thursday. They were contained within Maryland, and the sum of Maryland did not change, but the county distribution did, and I believe I spoke to the board members in Maryland last week about that. And then there was a change within the minor change in Virginia, which I also spoke to Ms. Hudgens about. So it doesn't change the total, but we actually wanted to present the new subsidy table as it appears today. And this chart here actually shows some of the changes that we recommended last Thursday. So it shows the parking revenue changes that the general manager had recommended, the 50 cents. It shows the additional 25 cents on paper fare cards. It shows the additional $4 fee, flat fee after midnight for use on rail, a slight increase on the bicycle locker fee, and then we show the express fee. That's the senior disabled, which doesn't, it's a rounding error, so it doesn't actually appear as a change on the chart. But those items, those new fare changes that I just indicated are the additional fares that are different than what was presented in the January proposed budget. And then we actually have the preventative maintenance and an additional jurisdictional subsidy request that the general manager made last Thursday of $26 million. So.
Okay.
And then the last chart is really just, again, providing the board guidance. In the appendix, and I won't go through it in detail unless you would like, at the request of some of the committee members, I think it was Mr. Zimmerman, we actually provided a side-by-side analysis of the Riders Advisory Council recommendations in order of preference. We list that in the appendix, and it's in very much detail. You can take a look at that, and if you have any questions, we can provide responses on that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kissel.
And I think we should comment that the Writers Advisory and the Coalition have given us a lot of information, and I think we've tried to incorporate that in all of the analysis in trying to arrive at what we think. In hearing customers say that they would accept an increased fare increase, what out of all of those recommendations or suggestions that they make will make the most sense in sense of equity, maintaining ridership, and all of those things. So I think that brings us to trying to arrive at a decision here as to how do we, what guidance we give forward here. And I'd like to start by us looking at, and I think the base chart, am I on page 15? Yes. Am I in the right place? Page 15. Is that the 101, Ms. Kissel?
No. No. You want the updated subsidy table?
It's the one I can't read. The one I can't read. Yeah, okay. Okay. And
what page are we on?
16. Page 16. Page 16. And that's it, the proposed fare changes. And I thought we had a better one here before, but hopefully this will help us.
There's one attached to the resolution also. I think it's the same. Attachment A, page 20, a little bit bigger.
Okay, well, we can, for those of us that need better sight, we can see our way through. I think we can get through it. I think that takes a, we're pretty defined here.
Ms. Hudgens, we're just going to take a few minutes, but we'll have it on an Excel sheet. I think it might be better to read, but.
Okay, that will help us. One of the things that we saw from the general manager is that he tried to take the guidance to say that we could generate a little bit more revenue from the customers by making some minor adjustments. And I think in what I think we need to look at is, do we accept all of these? Which items we have either concern in terms of the revenue to be generated or the impact on the customers? And what it does in shifting our delta in the budget as to what we conclude today. And so right now I'd like to hear from the committee members as to the beginning acceptance of Vistar, as this is a baseline, and are there any adjustments that they would see? And Mr. Benjamin? Yes. Yes.
I'd like to speak for Ms. Hewlett and myself. And I presume the state of Maryland, that although there are elements of this that are not entirely comfortable for us, we think this is a very reasonable proposal and one that we could give guidance to staff as it is to move ahead with.
Okay. Any other comments here? Mr. Graham.
Yes, we would propose for the District of Columbia, and this is something we feel very strongly about, is that the late night peak fare, the late night fare of $4 be changed to peak fare. And because we're very concerned that if we're charging a $4 fare, you know, we're going to reach the point where people are just going to take taxi cabs. You know, I mean, you're jointing, you know, and we're going to lose this very important service unwittingly and unintentionally. So we feel it's very important that there be a peak fare for late night weekends. And then, of course, we feel strongly that the system should be extended to 3 a.m. So those are the two points. We would suggest that we fix the peak fare, that we increase the peak fare to 20 cents in order to come up with the necessary revenue, and that we increase the maximum fare by 15%. And those two items combined would be $4.3 million, sufficient to cover the $4 million cost of what we are proposing.
Is there clear, I think I need some clarification to make certain that
what first of all, you are making an adjustment in the expense of the closing, and you're simply retaining what the general manager had.
Right. I think we.
What did you?
I too am having a little. This is a very complicated chart, Madam Chair, but I think that cutting through it, these are the three points.
Okay.
Did you understand me, Mr. Sarles?
Yes, let me just repeat it.
Make okay, sure the proposal.
No, I was going to repeat it back to you just so.
Oh, you repeat it. Go ahead. Yeah.
What I understood is rather than charging the flat fare of $4 after midnight, we would charge instead the peak period fare after midnight. And the second part was in lieu of closing at 2 a.m. and staying with the current 3 a.m., that we would make a between those two, and the revenue impact that or cost impact they have, that approximately equaled the revenue that we would derive by increase in the peak of the peak by what?
By the flat fare. Yeah. Eliminate the flat fare of $4 and increase the peak fare by 20 cents. Is that what you said? And then increase the max fare by 15%.
Rather than the 11%.
Right.
And
So
can you give us?
No, it's the peak of the peak.
Yeah, the peak.
You're
of
thinking about peak. Yes, thank you. Okay, I was wondering.
And
so peak of the peak, we had recommended a 10-cent fare increase. The recommendation from the district, as I understand it, Mr. Graham, is increasing that by another 10 cents, which would offset the $4 flat fee that we recommended, as well as reinstating the service to 3 a.m.
Right.
And so that would increase the peak of the peak, as the recommendation has it, by 5 million more.
3.5.
Yes, I think the 10 cent that we had recommended increased it originally by $5 million, and then if we add another 10 cents, it would increase it an incremental 3.5.
$3.5 million is my estimate.
That's correct. That's your estimate.
Of the peak of the peak.
Actually, our estimate was about $3 million, but we can take a look at that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, there's a distinction there, yeah.
Mr. Benjamin?
I thought I heard another proposal from Mr. Graham, which, according to Ms. Kissel, is not necessary, and that was to change the max fare. Sounded like just doing the peak of the peak solved the problem by itself. Is that right?
I believe it does,
yes.
In terms of the revenue trade-offs. The expense of running the subsidy saving for the rail after closing at 2 a.m. was $2.1 million. If we actually increase the service to 3 a.m., we have to find $2.1 million. The increasing the 10 cents, another 10 cents on peak of the peak, would create $3 million. So we'd have Oh, there was some confusion because we actually are looking at peak of the peak at 1.5 hours. You're not recommending extending the peak of the peak to 2 hours. Is that correct? Okay. So if we contained within the 1.5 hour peak of the peak, it would actually, the 10 cents gets us 5 million. If we add another 10 cents, that would actually get us another $5 million.
So more than enough to cover.
More than enough to cover the offsetting on the
So,
rail.
Mr. Graham, I would reluctantly support your proposal so long as we did not do anything to the max fare.
Okay, well, it doesn't seem as though we need to do anything
that's
to the max fare with these numbers.
Right.
So
that's correct.
We're not interested in doing that. So let the proposal then stand as the increase to 20 cents of the peak of the peak, and that would fund this sufficient to cover the concerns that we have.
Though there is one technicality, and that is for all of that to work, you probably would have to also apply the surcharge, the peak of the peak surcharge, to the max fare. Otherwise, you lose all the people who are at max fare. I don't know how you did your calculations. Right. So that would have to be a surcharge that would be applied to everybody. So it says anybody who rides in the peak of the peak and has the max fare would also have to get that surcharge, I assume,
yes,
by the way you calculated.
Yes.
So that part, at least, of what Mr. Graham said would have to stay.
And let me, can I just look at one thing for a moment? So we can take that three out.
So we're removing the 2.1 for the closing as an expense and the revenue from the peak of the peak.
Right, an extra revenue. And just let me clarify, if we do not do the $4 flat fee after midnight, we go back and return to the peak pricing, the differential there is $800,000, but it would still be able to, the other recommendations on peak of the peak would be offsetting on that. So.
Mr. McKay and then Mr. Lennon.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Benjamin. I think this is a very reasonable approach. One area where I do have a strong disagreement is the increase in parking fees. I think that's, you know, we're looking at major rail increases here for rail riders, and frankly, adding on top of that a parking fee, I think disproportionately hurts folks who are making the long hauls on our system. And you know, we have parking capacity at some of our parking lots that are out in the very suburban areas already that aren't being utilized. And frankly, I think we're going to lose a lot of revenue if we keep raising the parking increase. We know that next year there may be changes to how the federal government allocates benefits. We don't know how that's going to shake out. That is going to be particularly hurting some of our riders. So I do have an objection to raising the parking fees by 50 cents. And an alternative would be under the page 7 of what was sent out in advance is to reduce the discount for the rail-to-bus discount and also the bus-to-rail discount. And I know that total elimination of those discounts would bring in $12 million, but reducing the discount to 25 cents for each of those would bring in, if this math is correct, $6 million. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So I would offer that as an offsetting expense to the parking increase of 50 cents.
What would be, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. McKay makes the point that there's an additional burden on. Oh, I think Mr.
Well,
Linton was next.
Sorry.
I beg your pardon.
I was okay. If you would like to wait, then Mr. Linton.
Thank you. I know I would always defer to the board members who are actually on the committee. So if you wanted to continue, I will wait my opportunity.
I would like to do that, and if there's an objection to doing so, I would. If there is a desire to do so, I want to make it clear. I think it's important that all the board members participate in this discussion because, as been noted, we're not at a board meeting, but we are having a great deal of discussion relative to everyone. So I'm not excluding anybody. But go ahead, Mr. Graham, but I want you to make sure of that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, because you are next in line, and so
I wanted to defer to you, Mr. Graham.
What did that get you?
I hope you keep that in mind when you speak. Thank you very much, Mr. Linton. Mr. McKay makes the point, and I understand what he's struggling with. I understand what's going on here, of course, but, you know, that there is an additional burden on those who park. But, you know, this whole scheme places an additional burden on those who arrive at the station via bus. And what you're proposing as a remedy, and I'm willing to consider remedies to this to your issue, don't get me wrong, but would place an additional burden on our bus riders, and that of course is something that I'm very sensitive to for equally obvious reasons, and so I think if there's to be a remedy, we've got to find something else because I think we're already burdening the bus riders. And I don't want to reduce or eliminate this discount. But I'm willing to work with you, Mr. McKay, to see what else we have here. We've got a huge pot of things that we can work with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Linton.
I understand my colleagues from Maryland said that they could, this is painful, but they could live with this. And I'm listening to some of the discussion that I'm hearing this morning. But I'm curious, what is the policy? What's the public policy that we're trying to impart here? What is our fare policy, and what are we trying to do and encourage in terms of our pricing? I'm not quite sure. We talked about a flat fee for the late hour service. Just heard a proposal that suggests that we change that. It looks like we're putting some of that on the peak of the peak. Who in fact are we serving at this late hour service where we would have a flat fee? And who are we serving at the peak of the peak? What riders are we disadvantaging, and what's the percentage of riders who are peak of the peak based upon income or based upon premium riders who have other options? I'm not sure what kind of policy we are trying to achieve by the pricing, that discussion that we're having right now. Because I don't have those numbers, and it's interesting to me that the board is kind of making decisions without having those numbers too. And you should have those numbers in understanding what your policies you're trying to accomplish as you're putting together your fare proposal.
Well, in answer to one of your questions, we do have the riders for the after 2 a.m. or after midnight, and I think we provided that. It was a 3,000.
You did.
And who are they?
After 2 a.m., it was about 3,000 riders, and we don't have, we actually look to see what type of analysis. When we do surveys to actually do Title VI analysis and things like that, the Civil Rights Office had a very difficult time trying to drill down and identify the specific riders after 2 a.m. But we can actually go back and look at that. We'd have to look at our Fairgate exit data, because that's actually how we would actually look at it. We wouldn't be looking at surveys to get that information. So the surveys typically tell you things like income and other types of demographic information, which I think you're asking about. The Fairgate information would really just tell you where that person is going. And to some extent, it's not really accurate. Well, it could be accurate, but they may be going someplace for the weekend, or I mean, it's not really where they live. We would have to get that detailed information that you're requesting through surveys. Right now,
we did one.
We did a survey, yes.
We did one several years ago.
That's correct.
And we can make that available.
Several years, like when?
My guess is it's more than 5 years old. I don't have an exact date, but it's been enough.
We can actually get that data and take a look at it and see if it answers your questions, but I do not think it does.
And it's not just my question, because mm-hmm. you do have a Title VI, and I keep raising that, mm-hmm. and it's not something that people should just dismiss.
And I think the question that was asked, and I think we have response to, is when we looked at the general manager's proposal, I think you had done a Title VI. Is that true?
We did
okay,
a review.
We did not omit that part.
Yeah, but I'm saying now that we're making adjustments.
The question is going to be, we have to do that
a kind of analysis.
Right. You're exactly right.
And we can't do that off the back of an envelope because we don't know what the impacts are going to be.
No, there's no doubt that once the board provides the specific direction and gets closer to some of the activities that they want, fare and service, we will do a Title VI analysis and obviously would provide that to the board for under consideration.
Second part of that question is, what are the numbers that you are impacting or you're relieving some burden on those who are riding at the late hours, and you're kind of reallocating that to people who are riding on the peak of the peak? What percentage of our riders is the shift affected? Because you're actually saving a percentage and you're sharing that increase on a larger pool of riders, so you're impacting mm-hmm. primarily people who are peak hours who are commuting to work, I would assume. So you're actually mm-hmm. putting additional burden on them, and I'm not sure what the mm-hmm. both percentage and the makeup of the people who you're relieving. Mm-hmm. And that's a policy call, and I just think you don't just institute fares because of convenience and price and what makes the envelope fit. You got to figure out what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
Costa. Yes, thank you. And just to piggyback on Mr. Linton's comments, I think the question with peak of the peak is, and I'm looking at the Metro Riders memo where they've been advocating a peak of the peak a surcharge, and actually they're going further in terms of advocating a view where we should impose a higher fare in the peak direction. A higher peak of the peak fare. So the question really is, I'd just like your advice on this in terms of whether there is merit to the notion of using the peak of the peak fare surcharge to spread the ridership over our most congested period where we have our most expensive service out there, and whether this would actually do it, where we would see benefits in the long term to our system, because we're getting more even ridership, we're not getting crush-loaded conditions at the very top of the peak, and whether this fare change would essentially achieve that. I think from a policy standpoint, that's an important consideration, and that whether we're willing to use fares to encourage that sort of behavior, because we can't put, you know, every time we put out more trays, more cars, it costs this agency a lot. And that if we think we're going to get more ridership during those hours in the long term, perhaps imposing a surcharge like this makes sense. So I'd just like your thoughts on that, whether you've modeled this, whether you've evaluated this, and whether this is something that we should consider as a policy. Well, we also have a different situation here, where, unlike where we worked in Chicago, where we have a huge amount of riders that are on transit benefits. So, you know, but their behavior is a little more inelastic. So I'd like your thoughts on this.
Well, we've never done peak of the peak before. So it's, to some extent, it would be a new, we've had it recommended from a lot of the Riders Advisory Council, Greater Washington. A lot of folks have been giving us analysis on the merits of peak of the peak. Certainly there are merits to the fact that we actually try to direct or move people and even out, you know, sort of our congestion, as you pointed out. And that's a good thing. However, it's a form of what I would call congestion pricing that we have not done in the past. And so we're actually using some of our current models that we have on ridership and elasticity and things like that in order to derive what we believe is going to be the benefits of the peak of the peak. There's some limitations to that because, as some of you know, that economic model is not really built for that. But the fact is we've been very conservative in our estimates that you see here on the peak of the peak for that reason. So I'm not giving you we've baked in a lot of conservative estimates that would help us in this initial stage of trying to roll out a different method of pricing. To your point about is this benefits the system as a whole, I think, you know, maybe Mr. Kubitschek could respond to that, but I do believe there's some benefits in terms of spreading out your ridership, in terms of reliability, in terms of capacity and loads and things like that, and crowding. So.
I think we're good. Do you need anything further on that? I mean, basically what we're saying is peak of the peak, you know, theoretically should help spread a little bit, but because we don't have the pass data, you know, and we all know with models, you know, it's a little difficult. We'll actually see how the theory plays out here if we do this.
But you've taken a conservative approach to peak of the peak, and now one of the proposals that's at the table is adding additional costs to the peak of the peak.
Yes.
In addition to that, there's a question as to whether those changes of riders moving from a higher period to a lesser cost period mm-hmm. is discretionary. That's not necessarily a discretionary rise. Those are people who are governed to a large degree by their hours of work. So unless there's an environmental change within the region, in terms of employers and a number of other things, many of those don't have that kind of – it's not a discretionary ride, and the time period in which they travel is not discretionary. So we don't know that. And one of the things you don't want to do if you don't know that is put additional costs on top of that.
Well, we have given the committee – and we have analyzed 10 cents, 20 cents, even 30 cents. And with that analyzation, actually, we've been conservative with all of those estimates going forward. So I agree with you. But I think we've been conservative even if we actually increase it by a 20 cent, which was a recommendation that I heard earlier.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to draw the attention of the committee and the staff to a letter which we all –
could you speak in your mic, Mr. Can't hear you.
Mic's okay. Right there. Don't know that I can speak any closer to it. We received a letter earlier this week from the representatives of three organizations, the Coalition for Smarter Growth, Greater Washington, and MetroRiders.org, with a set of recommendations about precisely how to approach this question of fare policy. Now, you started this meeting by saying we need to give some overall guidance. And I have to say, in reviewing the letter that these three organizations submitted, what struck me, even more than the specific proposals, was the fact that it is based on a clearly identified set of goals and objectives that a fare policy should try to achieve, and then an argument for specific measures that are based on those goals. They said, here's what we think you should be trying to achieve with your fares, and if you agree, here's a reason why you should do this to rail fare, bus fare, and so on, parking the whole works. What's striking to me about what we are talking about here is there is no such explanation in anything that has been presented before us this morning. The presentation simply says fare changes, and there's an arbitrary number, and these add up to the number. The number, of course, has changed, and I should correct something I said last week. I believe I said last week that the new proposal from Mr. Soros on the budget simply substituted borrowing from capital from the earlier one. I was not correct. It substituted borrowing from capital plus additional charges on riders. I had missed that in fact, the amount to be asked from riders is now more than half of the gap-closing measure, which I'll say as an aside, I think is too much to ask of them. But in any case, it just seems to be an arbitrary number. But there's no rationale either for the total amount or for any of the specific things about which you are talking. And so we start talking, and anybody can go through here and pay. I got some too. You know, I don't think this one makes sense, and I could make that revenue up by substituting something else in it. But I really think that if you're going to give guidance and if we're going to set a rational policy, that it would make sense that we take an approach more like these folks who submitted recommendations from outside. And they, I think, did actually give a particularly rational, understandable set of objectives. They suggested the things you want to do are to maximize the number of transit trips for each dollar of operating assistance. I think we all agree with that. That we want to maximize the use of existing capacity, that we want to collect revenue efficiently, which means increasing the use of smart trip to reduce system costs and operational delays, and four, that we want to maintain jurisdictional and social equity. And then, so each of the questions that they discussed that we've been discussing here, several of them, they approach from that standpoint. And it leads to some different conclusions than what we're looking at here. For instance, in this discussion of peak of the peak, they argued for essentially a larger peak of the peak differential, because if you're really going to try and do it, really try and do it. And if, as Mr. Charles was just saying, you know, we don't actually know exactly what the behavioral impact will be. Maybe it won't move as many people as we think. Of course, if it doesn't move as many people, you get more revenue. So there are some benefits to doing that. The differential for cash and smart trips, another example. This just maintains the 10-cent differential. Now, you know, I have a question about whether a 10-cent differential is doing anything except charging 10 cents more to some people. The suggestion would be to increase the differential to something more meaningful that actually might affect that behavior. It also has an equity impact in that, you know, the people who have to go, you know, who travel every day here and who also are paying the taxes that subsidize it, you know, are one part of our ridership. And then there are the people who come from, you know, Des Moines and use it and aren't paying the taxes to run the system. And for the most part, the regular riders should have an opportunity to, you know, purchase fare at a lower rate, you know, for that very reason alone. And again, the differential helps to achieve that. You know, there are again, some other recommendations that they've made on how parking ought to be done. And I think that makes sense. But my main point is that there's a rational approach here as opposed to just picking things off. I mean, if I was going to pick one out, I'll give you one example you haven't talked about, which is the so-called airport shuttles and the proposal to greatly raise the fare there above an express fee. Well, those, of course, we have seen data that they're not airport shuttles. In fact, at least I certainly know in the case of the 5A that goes out to Dulles Airport, it turns out that a majority of those riders are not airport people. They're people commuting to work out in various places. So it makes no sense to charge this exorbitant fee to them beyond what somebody else riding express free in the other direction. Maybe there are people coming from, say, the District of Columbia to go to work out there. Now, I could look at that and say, well, that's X much, so tweak one of these other things to make that amount up. But this is a very ad hoc way to approach setting a fare policy. And I don't think that it leads to a good outcome either in revenue terms or in explaining to the public what we're trying to do or in achieving any of the policy goals we're otherwise stating.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I think we all received a letter from the coalition, and we also had the budget book that, as the budget was generated, each of the issues regarding policy were addressed there. And while we may have differences as to where we are, as to what the bottom line is, I think if you read in the budget book, each of the items that were provided by general manager gave us the guidance as to ridership, revenue, and equity on those policies.
But it doesn't establish a philosophy. And if the board is going to vote, you know, what's the board saying about what the approach is? What is the problem we're trying to solve? Are we just trying to meet a dollar number that's arbitrarily chosen, or are we trying to achieve some other things? I think the board should be clear about that. And regardless of what may have been in the original budget proposal, and I don't think it's ever been made explicit in any of the presentations we've gotten this year, certainly the additional, whatever it is, $20 million, and the number, by the way, differs on this page from the one in the earlier presentation, the earlier table, by a million or so. But the additional $20 million that Mr. Sarles proposes to take from riders, there's no indication of that about, you know, what the intention was here, that there was some, you know, some systematic choice here, or if it was just, I had to come up with $22 million, and here's how I can do it, so let's charge late-night riders $4 a piece. And, you know, Mr. Graham is right, at that rate, a whole lot of people are going to just get in cabs anyway.
Mr. Graham.
Well, I do want to say that there are policies, and there are policy pronouncements here, and let me quote, and I appreciate you quoting from the statement by the coalition, but let me quote from a letter that we have received from the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 689, where it is written by Jackie L. Jeter, president, I would note that closing the rail system at 2 a.m. on Friday and Saturday nights may have an indirect impact on businesses that are served by later weekend hours. Rail and bus passengers between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. are primarily service workers. Such businesses may be forced to close earlier, and such a move may have an impact on the transit-oriented development that has taken place around many of the metro stations, as well as those developments in the planning stages. Further, the $4 flat fare primarily impacts short trips that are vital to transit-oriented development and will adversely affect service workers who can least afford it. I hope that this proposal will be reevaluated and service paid for through increased subsidy or other means rather than increased fares. So we have that policy statement also from ATU, and that couples, previously I mentioned the other policies that are inherent in this change, and so I think we do have some real objectives on the table besides simply just increasing the fares. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graham, and I hope that that is the case. I think given a different environment, we could all stick to a very clear, solid policy guidance and try and arrive there. Unfortunately, it's a little bit different here. And
sorry, Madam Chairman, could you explain that? I mean, if you want to get to a certain number, that's the environment. You need a certain amount of money. You can still approach it as, I want to get to that number, the best way to achieve such and such goal. So you could have the number by having an across-the-board increase in a fare, or you could say it makes more sense to raise it more at this time and less at that time. If you raise the fares too much at times when we have excess capacity, then that's probably not very efficient. So you would presumably want your fare structure to reflect the goal, not just of, you know, smoothing out in the sense of reducing the peak, but also not discouraging riders at times when you have empty seats. If you have empty seats on a bus, and we may have a big subsidy on the average bus rider, but the marginal bus rider is another story. You put somebody in an empty seat on a bus, that's just pure revenue to the system. So you wouldn't want to discourage that. And what I'm saying is it's not clear to me that this is structured in a way that is aimed at that goal. And the fact that this has been pointed out by some people on, you know, right from the outside, I think they've raised questions that go to the very heart of what we should adopt. And I don't think you want to adopt a fare increase of larger than anyone's ever seen here before without taking into consideration the possibility that structuring it differently would have a better outcome, both in terms of revenue riding and revenue raising and in terms of the impact on the riding public.
I think you're correct, Mr. Graham, and I think that, I'm sorry, Mr. Zimmerman, but I think the other part of that is that we are dealing with what will be the bottom line of it. And so what we choose really does have an impact on that. And while Mr. Graham has really given his view as to what he read from the other guidance on late night closing, it is one that was recommended that had to do with the better utilization of the services. So I think we have some compromises that we need to make, and that we have to make them with as much guidance as possible from here. And I'd like to ask the question from staff in terms of where we are in here. For example, I wanted to offer Mr. McKay articulated my concern about the parking. I think it's a piece that we've raised before. If all things were equal in the system, we could all say that by driving the market on parking, we could move people where we want them. But if you don't have a system that feeds them, there is no market to drive them to. So I think that's where we are with that. I think in order to make up the differences, I think we could go higher on the peak to peak. Mm-hmm. We could spread the hour and either leave it at 10 or at 20, and it would make up the difference in revenue. It is a question of whether or not we are comfortable with the peak and the peak of the peak change. And if we are conservative in our guidance, it gives us some sense of cover. It also gives us the opportunity to, I think Mr. McKay raised the discount, eliminating the discount or reducing it. And I think it does deal with a little bit of what was spoken of in the Riders Advisory, the coalition, their recommendations. And that allows us to generate a little bit more revenue and still have the discount available to those that are there. So I think that would allow us. And Ms. Kissel, what is the amount on expanding it to the 2 hour?
Expanding the peak of the peak to 2 hour on the on 10 cents would be actually $8 million, where if we had it on the 1.5 hour, the 10 cents would be five. And then on 20 cents,
on two hours,
that would be actually $15
million. And that's?
Yeah, so that would be in total, the $15 million. So that includes partially the $10 million that was in the general manager's budget. That would on the 1.5 hour, the additional 10 cents, and we'd add another $5 million to that. These are just our estimates based upon, as I said, some of the variables and models that we had currently. So,
Yes.
So one of the things that was pointed out in the letter which I was quoting is that it's not just a matter of the amount of the differential for peak of the peak, mm-hmm. which, you know, as opposed to a 10 cents, they propose a 50 cents, which seems to me far more meaningful. Also, I think has some equity benefits. But they also added the nuance that it should only be for rail trips that traverse the congested core. So again, you target it to solve the problem you're actually trying to address, and thereby better spreading the ridership. They also suggested that relative to bus, that there be a peak of the peak surcharge of 25 cents, but because you don't want people being, you know, simply shifting, you know, onto bus, but they also noted that the surcharge for bus should be erased for trips entailing both bus and rail by raising the transfer discount by 25 cents during the peak of the peak time. So in other words, it recognizes the potential offsetting effects. And again, that's a level of nuance that I think is fairly important, but that we haven't seen treated in any of this.
Well, Mr. Zimmerman, I think we'd be willing to let me speak for myself. I saw a lot of things that I would be willing to attempt, but we just found that we have a 60-day window to make adjustments, to test them, and we don't have data to support where we would like to go. There were several recommendations in that
that allowed us to drive our changes to the most utilized parking lots, to the most utilized stations at the most utilized hours, et cetera. I think that's great guidance. It's great guidance that we should be using consistently, and I think it's what was attempted. But I think my hearing from the staff that we've not done this before, the question is how much additional programming is needed to program various stations driven by certain data that we've not collected. And I think that's the only
Madam Chair, I'd say I think it's precisely because we haven't done this before that we need to be sure we get it right. And I would also note that contrary to the statement that we're going to be ready to go on June 27th, Ms. Gissel already told us this isn't ready to go on June 27th. Even if you gave the direction today, one of the first things she said this morning was parts of this won't be and would be implemented later. And frankly, I would suggest you don't even try to do that because for some of the very reasons Mr. McKay was speaking to earlier, I think we ought to have the whole package ready to go on one day. And if that's July 15th and not June 27th, whatever it is, I think it would be better to know exactly what you are doing. Since this peak of the peak and all this we're talking about can't be implemented anyway in that time frame, it seems like it wouldn't make sense to not do it right because we're rushing to do it when it wouldn't be ready to launch on day one anyhow.
You're absolutely right. August 1st on the peak of the peak. I did not get a copy of this letter until today. I was not copied on the letter, which I have in front of me now. And I think my staff got it last night. So we did a very broad brush of, looking at, what we'd have to actually calculate to try to figure out whether or not these made sense, both from a policy standpoint as well as from revenue. So we'd have to make some assumptions on how many AM and PM trips were at the core stations. We'd have to make some assumptions on elasticity. We'd have to make some assumptions on other things. And I'm happy to do that. I think that we could probably work with some of the folks outside who actually put this together and some of my folks, and we could actually have something for the board probably in the next week or two, depending on how complicated this was, for your consideration. I would offer that.
I would welcome that, Madam Chairman.
Are you saying that you would have that to us for the 13th meeting?
I would attempt to have that for the 13th meeting, and specifically the peak of the peak that they're recommending at the core congested areas on rail, the 50 cents. I think that's the biggest piece.
And the bus differential.
And we can look at the bus differential. I'd have to bring some of these folks in who looked at this as well as some additional resources, but I think we can actually get some a good hard analysis. Obviously, I'm not prepared today to do that because I have not even looked at this. So.
Madam Chairman, I would also urge that you really look
but
at
that
the
would not
cash
impact,
differential.
Oh, I'm sorry. That would not impact the rest of the time frame because, as I mentioned,
you're
the
already late on it anyway. But I would, again, Madam Chairman, I would also suggest really looking at the cash differential. If it's only a dime, I'm not sure it's worth having at all, but I think we should be looking at a larger differential.
And I think that I don't have a problem with moving for that.
That also, I believe, was in Ms. Jeter's letter.
Right. And let me say that I think in doing that, it gives us a greater opportunity to reach out to those populations that, for some reason, are still using the other, and therefore move them where we want them doing so. I'm simply going to ask if there are any other recommendations that we would make and ask staff to give us some to help us in terms of deriving where we are actual amount would be, so that board members have some guidance as well as what the changes are. Mm-hmm. And I think there have just been four changes, approximately that. I think that's right.
The $4 flat fee.
Right.
No parking increase. The 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. And peak after midnight. Or the peak of 20 cents after midnight.
And the peak of the peak.
Yes.
And the peak of the peak. I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Wait a minute. Let me be clear about this.
Okay.
So there's no parking increase at all?
Well, that's what we'll look at. Well, right. What I've been asked to look at is those, all the comments, and sort of.
I think that's what you suggested.
Yeah, that is what I suggested. Right. No parking increase
that
at all.
That was no parking increase.
Mm-hmm. And where is the, okay, just go over it one
yeah,
more
sure.
time. So
it would be the no parking, we'll start with that. No late night, the late night service going to 3 a.m., continuing that service. Charging peak service, peak fares after midnight, rather than the
peak
fare. Flat fare, the $4 flat fare.
Instead of the $4.
No, it's peak fares.
Peak fares, excuse
right.
me.
Not peak of the peak.
It's that's
peak,
correct.
It's right.
peak. Charging, fares. That's correct, peak fares. Sorry.
Every moment you have to struggle. You have to.
I'm sorry.
Peak fares after midnight.
That's correct. And then the peak of the peak.
What's the increase in the peak of the peak?
Well, we're going to analyze that. It's a one and a half hour time frame that we're speaking about. We know that. But we'll analyze the 10 cents.
So you're going to go to 2 hours as the time frame?
No, we're going to stick to the 1.5 hours.
Why is that?
We could look at, no one's mentioned expanding the hours, but we can.
Yeah, there's some concern on spreading from 1.5 to 2 hours, I believe, because of the push then, potential push of people out of the peak into just the shoulder of the peak, and whether we actually have the capacity, as I understand, to accommodate that without increasing.
So we're leaving the 1.5 hours?
That's correct.
And then we're increasing the peak of the peak fare by how much? I had suggested by 10 cents.
We'll look at 10 cents. We have. We looked at 20 cents, and we'll look at the proposal that's currently on the table at 50 cents for rail in the congested areas.
Well, so it doesn't sound like we're going to be reaching anything.
Well, we can have that analysis done by May 13th on those
yes.
sides.
So, but no action then today.
Well, I think we are saying. What are we not saying we can't do today?
I think what we're saying is these are the exceptions that the committee would like us to hold out on, and then the which assuming that all the other fare increases we can get some direction on and move forward on. That's correct.
And I think most of what we're revolving around is adjustments to the peak of the peak.
I'm sorry, Mr. Searles, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. What we're revolving around is to accommodate some of these changes is how much adjustment to the peak of the peak there is, and that's the one area we said we have to set aside anyhow and take a little bit longer to do. So what I understand from this discussion, if that's what the committee wants to do and the board wants to do, or the committee, I should say, is we could then begin to program all the other increases that we need to get going now on if we're going to make June 27th. And then when the decision is made with regard to peak of the peak and that sort of thing, then we'll implement that, but that'll be a separate effort, right?
Okay. Is that agreement with everyone?
Just check. What did Mr. McKay withdraw his balance transfer adjustment?
Well, I had that on the table as a way to offset the lost revenue that would have been gained from the parking increase, and I still contend that the reduction is a fair way to do that, not the elimination, and that happens to offset the cost of parking.
So should we include that in the second?
I would like to have that. I mean, we didn't really talk about the remedies. What was just listed was the things we'd like to see not further cut or increased, and I didn't really hear a full discussion of all the remedies that were put on the table for each of the things, but I would hope that in the analysis we do continue to look at a reduction in discounts, whether it's used to offset parking or not. It's kind of immaterial at this point in the conversation, but I do think it's something that should be on the table to help offset some of these other costs besides just the peak of the peak analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what? I'm sorry. So we're not acting today.
Yes, we are acting today. The question is there anything left off the table? And the only thing that we've said is the peak and the peak were the ones that needed to have the further analysis. Mm-hmm. That's what you said. That is, there is not a problem of changing the $4 flat after midnight to peak.
That's correct.
And there is not a problem in changing the expense piece for 2 a.m.
Right.
Because it would be offset with what we expect to generate minimally from peak of the peak.
That's correct.
And therefore, in removing the parking, we can expect, depending on which of the peak of the peaks you have
8 or 15 million to offset that change. And the only thing left is the discount, and that was the one that we would lead to reducing it rather than eliminating it. And it was on both or
yes,
one?
On both.
It was on both.
Right. Okay. And just for clarity, that is something I'm throwing on the table if we can't get there with the adjustment to the peak of the peak. If we can get there with the adjustment to the peak of the peak, then I'm fine not doing that. But what I'm suggesting is if we stay at 1.5 hours or we stay at 10 cents and we don't go to 20 cents, that could be used as a substitute to make up that amount. But I would say first we should look at peak of the peak analysis, and only after that, if there's not agreement to go to that extent, that be used as another possible way to substitute that revenue.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, I think we were doing so well, you know, and I up until that, you know, I think that we slip off the wagon at that point in terms of our support for this. So, I mean, if we leave the discount, I mean, can't we consider that at another time if we have to, and instead have the guidance be to look to peak of the peak where we know there'll be funds sufficient to take care of your...
Well, we don't know that there will be.
Well, we're pretty sure, aren't we?
Well, based upon the proposal that we have at the 10 cents, it wouldn't cover
If you went to a higher...
But if we went from 20 and then to 50, yes, that's correct. It would cover...
I'd rather see that approach taken, and then we, if need be, come back to us and say, well, that approach doesn't work, and then we can. But I don't feel comfortable giving an authorization via a guidance that would lead to the discount issue being changed. So, Madam Chair, if I could, I don't know whether that's acceptable, but if we can, I think we can accommodate the interest, which is to forego a parking increase by taking that approach. And so I think we should limit ourselves to that.
Mr. Zimmerman?
I definitely think we need to comment on your point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I just have one other point.
And, you know, to agree that I think we need to know what the other revenue raises before you start negotiating changes in something you may not have to do. Personally, I would need to know what the impact, especially on short trips, is of changes in the differential. I don't feel like I know that right now, but that's one of the things that makes me uncomfortable about it. So I'd like to see that. But once you, if you do the other kinds of things we were just talking about, including the difference in, you know, cash differential and all that, how do the numbers fall out?
Right.
Maybe we can take care of the problem, as Mr. Graham just suggested, anyway. But this shows the difficulty of trying to negotiate a fare package today.
It is difficult. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just one other thing, and I know we're now approaching an agreement, so I don't want to, but in our packages, there was the concept of a station-specific 5-cent surcharge for capital improvements up to 2 stations in each jurisdiction. Is that still in here?
It is there.
All right.
Is it?
Yes. You've got to go down farther and chart, but it's in there. It's on line.
Yes.
Oh, can you paste down?
Line 380.
if you go down, I'll point it out to you. I saw it.
It's
right here.
Yeah.
Implement.
Right. Yes.
It's still in there.
Implement.
Okay.
Special.
So,
yeah.
So that's still there. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Questions?
Let's
Mr.
Yule. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Yule.
I apologize. I had to go to COG for a program presentation, but what are the numbers in the red, the column that's in red? Are those adjustments?
Ridership change.
That the ridership council. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, do we need a motion?
I think we would need a motion that this committee would direct staff to move forward with the recommended adjustments and provide to us as committee members, and I'd like to see it by next week as to what this bottom line looks like so that we can all. You can move forward, and the recommendations have been indicated.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor? Any discussion? I think we've had it. All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much for your guidance. And the next item is Mr. Benjamin is going to kick off for us to move to executive session.
Yes, we will have a short executive session on legal and contract issues associated with the capital program?
Madam Chairman?
Yes. Yeah,
before we leave, I want to say again, not having been party to that vote, that as a member of the board, I reserve the right to present, you know, any changes to whatever it is. I'm not actually sure what direction you gave, but when we see what it is, you know, I will not feel bound by anything that you may have feel you decided today, because I think we need to get the right policy when we're done, and we'll need to see all the numbers on the table before we do, which it seems to me we don't have. Let me say at the outset, though, I think that this is overall asking for a bit too much on the riders alone. I think the overall package should not be more than half of the cost being put on the riders themselves, and this is higher than that. And since it also, you know, takes out from capital, it's taking the riders that way as well, and unfortunately does not expect the jurisdictions to step up the small amount that would make it completely unnecessary to do any of that. It's an amount that you and I have both included in budgets, which involved great budget gap closing measures ourselves, as Mr. McKay pointed out, and I don't think we should be giving up on that. If you could find it in your budget, I just cannot believe that Maryland, with more than $20 billion of budget, much larger than your budget, can't come up with a little bit more that would take some of the burden off the riders and protect the system.
Well, as indicated, and I'm going to pass this down to Mr. Yule, we don't disagree philosophically. It's whether or not in practicality I can execute it. And that's the part that I think we're dealing with. I would hope that this has given us a lot more latitude to think about where we can put other additional dollars on the table and deal with subsidies. And while we heard from our riders that they would rather have their fares increased rather than have the service cuts, they also encouraged us that they felt it was the equitable responsibility of the jurisdictions to provide this. Mm-hmm. As indicated, all of us in Virginia have indicated that we're willing to do that. There is no obligation for us to, let me put it this way, for what we've moved forward today, we have, I think, a good start in trying to remove some of the items that we felt from a fair standpoint were more onerous on our riders. Mr. Serrell's budget also helped to do that. So I think we've moved in that direction. I am one that will continue to keep speaking with my colleagues regarding the remaining portion of the budget. Yes,
yeah, and
McKee and then Mr. Green.
Right. I just wanted to also comment, since some of us have hand-picked portions of letters to read and told half of the story, I'll read another excerpt from the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 689 letter that was not read, which is my hope that all jurisdictions will meet the full amount of the share of jurisdictional subsidy under Mr. Snarl's plan or under any subsidy increases determined necessary by the board and not resort to service reductions or other measures such as increased fares beyond those levels proposed. Quote, end quote, Jackie Jeter. So when we read letters and pick excerpts from them, we have to read the full letter, and there's that component as well, and that's towards the end of the letter that if all the other things can't be dealt with, still on the table is exactly what Mr. Zimmerman mentioned, which is that the jurisdictions come to the table and avoid service cuts, which is certainly something that, you know, I would love to see happen too. In reality, I think we moved in a direction today that we should, dealing with there may not be an opportunity for everyone to do that. But frankly, the union, as well as others, have suggested repeatedly that that be a solution to the problem as well.
Madam
Chair, well, let's, you know, we haven't kept in mind some of the numbers from our last session, which was just 1 week ago. And I don't have the precise number in mind, but we now have the service reductions in terms of the amount of subsidy savings down to a very small amount indeed. And particularly since there does seem to be some agreement about not closing the system at 2 a.m., that takes another $2.4 million out. If my memory serves me correctly, we're now down to about $4 million in service reduction. So I think we have really done a heck of a job in terms of that particular issue. I just want to mention a word of caution, because, and I know, again, I'm very much appreciative of our chairperson's role here. She's been extremely adroit in how she's handled this. But I think we should be a little careful about saying our riders want fare increases, because in fact, you know, the percentages here were just a little bit more than 50%. And I have heard from a whole lot of people who don't want any fare increase and who want us to find the dollar somewhere else. And so, you know, we've got to be respectful of the fact that a lot of people don't want fare increases, and also a lot of people can't afford fare increases. And so, you know, the way, you know, poor people who are transit dependent to a greater extent than other people, you know, are going to be hard hit by these bus fare increases, for example. But we face a great, excuse me, Mr. Linton, we face a great challenge here in terms of balancing this budget. But I think we have to keep in mind the impacts that some of this is going to have, particularly on certain groups of people. And so I just wanted to make that point. But I think we've done well in terms of reducing the amount of service reductions. And today's action in terms of the 2 a.m. closing is a huge step in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you. Did we, Mr. You had the motion,
no motion.
It is not a motion, an announcement that we are going into executive session. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.